This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago on the Hawaiian island of Maui. This tourist is stranded at the airport.
You could see the fires from the distance. It was really scary.
Those wildfire flames sent some running into the ocean to escape. At least six people have died. Maui County Mayor Richard Bisson says some closed schools have been turned into emergency shelters as more firefighting efforts shift to the sky.
We now have helicopters that were unable to get up in the air yesterday that are now using water drops to help suppress the fire.
KGMB-TV's Chelsea Davis spoke by phone to a resident who escaped by boat and described what she saw on Maui.
She said it was just nothing that anyone has experienced ever before. She said it is an absolute war zone, unrecognizable. Places have burnt down. We've seen the videos, homes, businesses. She says it's lost for words.
CBS News confirms the details in a Trump campaign memo that lays out a post-election plot to use fake electors to block then-President-elect Joe Biden from taking office. CBS's Robert Costa.
Court documents tonight reveal the special counsel obtained a search warrant for former President Donald Trump's Twitter account, seeking more information as it continues to investigate the attempt to overthrow the 2020 election. Trump responded immediately on social media, calling the search warrant a major hit on my civil rights.
A Utah man, Craig Robertson of Provo, was shot and killed during an FBI raid on his home early this morning. CBS's Ed O'Keefe reports agents were attempting to serve an arrest warrant.
The FBI had been investigating Robertson for 5 months for allegedly making threats against other officials, among them Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, New York Attorney General Letitia James, and Attorney General Merrick Garland, all of them overseeing criminal or civil proceedings against former President Donald Trump.
Michael Lorenzen of the Philadelphia Phillies throws a no-hitter against the Washington Nationals. The FAA turns to the FBI to help address violence in the skies. CBS's Allison Keys.
The FAA has just referred another 22 cases of unruly passengers to the FBI for possible criminal charges. The agency says it can seek fines of up to $37,000 against badly behaved passengers, but it has no law enforcement authority. The FAA has referred more than 270 cases to the FBI since 2021 and says unacceptable behavior continues to occur.
The winning $1.5 billion Mega Millions ticket was sold at a supermarket in Neptune Beach, Florida, where this man was shopping today. He thinks people will now swarm to the area.
It's going to change the whole town. I mean, I think it's going to turn upside down from this.
This is CBS News.
Hire with minimal effort and max speed with Indeed. Their hiring solution platform helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates efficiently. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Thanks for listening to your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more on our website, civicmedia.us.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. Wisconsin wildlife officials are reminding people to be careful when swimming or boating. At least 9 people have died in Wisconsin lakes and rivers this year, including no fewer than 5 last weekend. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources says wear a life jacket whenever you're on a boat. A teenage murder defendant in Chippewa Falls will find out in January whether he'll be tried as a child or as an adult. A reverse waiver hearing that started Monday finished late this morning. The boy is accused of killing 10-year-old Lily Peters last year. He's now 15 years old. The prosecution and the defense will make written statements to Judge Stephen Gibbs. Those are due in November. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
Did you know the Wisconsin State Fair is 172 years old? It still celebrates the industries important to our state's history, like agriculture. But every year, new attractions and items are added. This year, there's more than 100 new foods to try. So what do you think topped the culinary list last year? Flamin' hot Cheetos chicken on a stick? Deep-fried old-fashioned? Or Pino pretzel popper brat? The answer's coming up. The Wisconsin State Fair didn't start in its current home of West Allis. The first was in Janesville along the Rock River, then moved to different locations the next 40 years. The original cream puff has been around almost as long. Close to 400,000 are gobbled up every year. So which food was number one last year? It was the Pino pretzel popper brat. it came out on top. The State Fair is a true slice of Wisconsin, and it runs through August 13th. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
I have Corrine Hendrickson, part of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Action Needed group.
The Joint Finance Committee, again in the middle of the night, took that out and said, well, hey, you have all this money coming from the federal government. Why don't you use that to create this program? Well, guess what? We proved it worked. Wages went up $2 an hour. There actually are a couple extra childcare businesses open now than there were about a year ago, and that's going to stop. Just Monday, we lost two.
Weekday morning, 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Hey, son, how are you feeling?
I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it.
When your kid can't find the language, find the lyrics. Start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ed Council and Pivotal Ventures.
It's What's on Tap for the Chippewa Valley. 93.5 The Tap.
Google or Amazon Podcasts. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site formerly known as Twitter. At Green News Report.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as I've been saying, Republicans hate working people. Look at their policies. Prevailing wage used to be something, as we said, you know, Republicans used to stand by. Both Davis and Bacon were both Republicans. Now, granted, Pennsylvania, New York, those were working class strongholds. Those were union strongholds, so you'd understand. But look, you know, I go back to the Gingrich era. You had some 90 pro-prevailing wage Republicans. You don't have that today. And you look at the states like West Virginia, who have gone and done away with not just that, but right to work and everything else, and then have turned around and gone, look, you know, gutting this stuff did not help us. And what we know is prevailing wage has a positive reverberation effect throughout an economy. And that's why I've asked Lee Harris to come talk with us. She's a reporter over at the American Prospect, prospect.org, their website. She's got a piece on this very topic that I said, you know what? I got to reach out. I got to grab her on the program. Lee, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on. Excited to be here.
So what I liked about your piece, to be quite frank, is that it went into some of the history and the importance. I saw a bunch of reporting on it going, oh, the administration's going to do this, and not really talking about what they're going to do. So, you know, real quick, you know, walk me through what the administration's plan is to revive Davis-Bacon and undo some of the attacks of the past.
For sure. I mean, the first thing to say is I saw you had Jimmy with the painters on just before me, and it's certainly true that this is something that labor leaders have spearheaded. It's going to be one of the biggest wins for unions out of Bidenomics and the whole package of pro-worker legislation that the president has passed. But something that doesn't get talked about enough is it's also going to help, arguably, potentially even help non-union workers more, including migrant workers, especially in right-to-work states, because it means that anyone on a job site that's being funded with federal money has to be paid that prevailing wage. So it lifts everyone to a prevailing wage standard, which is often the collectively bargained rate for a region. And what's really powerful about it is, you know, unions will talk about this as it puts everyone on an even footing. So it prevents a race to the bottom where, you know, out-of-state workers can come in, or out-of-state contractors can come in and undercut local union wages. But it also means that it sort of lifts standards for unions and non-union workers across the board. That's sort of the top line to understand. The way it does this is it reverses a change that was made in the early 80s. So from the time that Davis-Bacon was enacted during the Depression until the 1980s, a wage rate was prevailing if it was paid to at least 30% of workers in an area. That meant that often, if 30% of workers in a given region are paid the same level, that's probably the collectively bargained rate that unions have arrived at. Now, if there was no wage that was paid to more than 30% of workers, then they would default to the weighted average of pay in the region. But Ronald Reagan's Department of Labor changed that and eliminated that 30% rule to say you have to have a majority of workers in an area, in a given area, paid a certain rate. And at a time when union density was declining, that made it much less likely that prevailing wage would correspond to a wage that workers were actually paid, and much less likely that it would correspond to a union rate. So it made that kind of race to the bottom much more likely. One thing I want to say on the history is I love how you frame things in terms of this not so much being a Democrat-Republican issue, because I interviewed the historian Andrew Elrod, who's been doing really great original research on these issues, which I think has been useful actually to folks within the building trades. And what he's found, or I guess to kind of summarize his work, what's been interesting to me is that the history of Davis-Bacon being gutted in the 70s and 80s is really about both parties selling out workers, all the way from kind of starting with Nixon, but then through Ford, Carter, and with Reagan kind of dealing the final blow, but dealing with rising prices in the 70s by having workers exclusively take the hit rather than, for example, by considering more progressive taxation schemes. So yeah, while it's the Reagan Department of Labor that finally deals this hit to Davis-Bacon by eliminating the 30% rule, it's really Carter who sets the stage for that to happen.
No, you're not. You're absolutely right. It's the same thing with trucking deregulation and airline deregulation. That was Teddy Kennedy and Jimmy Carter who did that. But the Reagan administration used that and really put the pedal to the metal to accelerate the decline, especially in those industries. Now, you could argue, as some of my more liberal friends have done, that Carter and Kennedy had a more, we care about consumers, we think this isn't going to be as bad for workers, and they had an idea that it was going to help with the energy crisis that was going on and the stagflation that was going on. They had altruistic kind of theories that they were working on, whereas Republicans actually knew this was going to be the demise of unions in this, and a way to crush those industries. So it doesn't really matter what their motives were. The results are still the same. We are in this moment. And I think that's important to point out.
Agreed, totally. And I think also the proof of how strong of a reform this is by Biden's Department of Labor is the fact that industry groups are so horrified by it. I mean, the Associated Builders and Contractors, this famously anti-union trade association, is probably going to file suit pretty quickly challenging this law. And I think the Biden DOL took a while preparing it because they're ready to go to bat for it. And the other thing is, there are these kind of, I think, political changes that are about supporting American workers. There are also just technical modifications to a law that hadn't been updated in 40 years, essentially. Prevailing wages had gotten really out of date in some areas. There's a great piece about how workers were being paid according to prevailing wage rates that were last measured in the 1980s. And it brings those wages up to speed partly by empowering the Department of Labor's wage and hour administrator to just say, okay, we don't have a specific survey for this region. I'm going to issue a determination for a given labor classification where we don't have enough data. And it gives a little more authority to the Department of Labor to set rates that correspond to what workers actually make.
No, this is a big deal. And I'm glad you brought that up, because you know, you think about the stagnant wages of the last 40 years and the drivers for that wage stagnation. This is a big part of that. In places that don't have strong union density, you know, outside of New York, Philadelphia, you know, Chicago, the big cities, you know, unions don't have the kind of density that they have in those places. So they don't have the ability to enforce and drive the wage growth in those places. So those places have been stagnant for decades. And it's been harmful, not just to those rural and other communities, but also to the bigger cities, because you do get transients coming through to try and take work, and unscrupulous contractors who are going to break the law and misclassify people so they can cheat them out of wages, which again is why the enforcement part of this is so very important.
Yep. I think where this is going to really matter is on infrastructure that's crumbling, and the kinds of regular infrastructure updates that we already know need to be made, from roads and bridges to other forms of ordinary infrastructure, but also on these big new industrial policy investments that the administration has made in chips, domestic semiconductor manufacturing to compete with Asian competitors and bring back some of this production of cutting edge electronics. On the Inflation Reduction Act, with things like EV production and solar panels and all of that green technology that we're convinced we're going to be installing, so it should come from American workers. We have seen a surge in the construction of manufacturing sites, especially electronics sites, but a lot of that is anticipating money that's going to be coming down from the federal money that from the federal government that hasn't actually gone out the door yet. And so the fact that Davis-Bacon is being updated now means those really have a shot at being much better jobs for workers. And just to give you one example of somewhere where you might think that Davis-Bacon wouldn't be a problem, because a number of states have their own little Davis-Bacon regulations and already pay prevailing wages for all sorts of reasons. But this reform matters in sort of deep blue states as well, partly because enforcement hasn't been very good. And so just to give you one example of a positive story about enforcement in Illinois, which has a very pro-union governor, the attorney general found that Rivian, the electric truck maker and Tesla competitor, Rivian's building a huge plant in Normal, Illinois. It turns out they went through subcontractors and brought in workers from Mexico who weren't paid overtime, who were denied wages that they were owed and then just sent back to Mexico. So that it's a loss of work for the local economy, and it's deeply unjust to these migrant workers who are treated as easy to exploit. That's something that they only found out because of a tip from the local labor union that realized that this was going on. But a lot of these green manufacturers are not automatically going to be paying wages that workers are owed, much less paying prevailing wages, unless the DOL beefs up enforcement in the way that it's attempting to do with this law.
Yeah, I mean, I think every federal dollar that goes out the door, a prevailing wage should be attached to it. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show with Lee Harris. Lee's a reporter over at The American Prospect. You can check out their website, prospect.org, and her most recent piece on the Biden administration's labor rule. We'll get links out on social media how you can take a look at this. Now, you know, as I said, I think all federal projects, all federal money, and look, I think even state money in places should have prevailing wage attached to it because it works. I mean, this is where I come back to the sanity of good policy, smart investment, sound policy. I look at the tale of two bridges, and I'm sure you've seen this, the Tappan Zee in New York and the Bay Bridge in California. You know, the one in California, not done with prevailing wage laws and not done with project labor agreements. The Tappan Zee done all under prevailing wage, all under project labor agreements. One is done on time, under budget, and complete. The other's never going to get done, and had a, what was it? It was $250 million to start. It eventually swelled up to $6.5 billion and is never going to be complete. So for me, as someone who is a little frugal with money and wanting to spend the taxpayers' dollar judiciously and getting the most bang for the buck, this seems like smart policy because I've seen it in action in the tale of two bridges, the one in New York done with a project labor agreement, done with prevailing wage, on time, under budget, and complete, the other one not so much. So this seems like kind of a no-brainer to me.
It seems that way to me too. The other thing to say is I think it kind of complements the other big prong of Biden's manufacturing strategy, which has been, let's face it, the Biden administration is giving out pretty major subsidies to big, powerful private corporations. And he's doing that in order to reshore, you know, manufacturing and create jobs and to meet national security objectives. And there are all sorts of reasons that the administration has spelled out for doing that. But Biden isn't asking companies to pay prevailing wage for nothing. These are federal dollars that are going out to major, highly competitive companies, many of them with enviable profit margins. And he's asking that if the government is creating these jobs, they should be good jobs that support the middle class.
No, and one of the things I like that you went into your piece is that this is going to help raise the conditions and the standards in red states. And you know, one of the things I give Biden credit for, that you know, he's a much better person than I am. I would be maybe a little bit more vindictive. I might lean a little bit more towards Trump and going after people who didn't support me. But Biden's, you know, across the board, helping the entire country. These policies are actually, I would argue, benefiting red states a lot more than blue states. And that might be a good thing, might get him more votes. But it's about rebuilding the whole country and rising, you know, all the boats and not just a few.
At this point, Brian Kemp, the governor of Georgia, has not met an EV he didn't like. I mean, the new battery belt in the southern United States is going to be pumping out just incredible numbers of electric cars. I mean, I do wonder, Rick, if it was a deliberate strategy by the administration for so many of these jobs to go to red states, or maybe a little bit of a mistake on the administration's part, or if they were caught off guard by it, let's say that. And so one big question politically, especially going into the election, will be if they can take a victory lap and they're delivering these jobs, are people gonna associate Biden with having delivered these major investments and lifted up whole communities? And it's interesting to me that it was Vice President Kamala Harris who gave this announcement in Philadelphia about the DOL changes, obviously not the most popular figure in the administration, although I think they're kind of trying to revamp her public face ahead of the election. Just an interesting choice, I thought. But yeah, I definitely a lot of these jobs are going to red states, and it's now Biden's task to take credit for what he's delivered.
And as I said from the beginning, and I said this, you know, right when the bill was passed, they should take that sticker that they were slapping all over the gas pumps that said Biden did this, and they should blow it up to 20 feet high cutouts, and at every project have a Biden did this statue, so that people do know where it came from. At least that's my thought. It is a start. So last question I've got for you, you know, in looking at this, for me, the teeth in the dog is always the most important. You talked about the enforcement mechanism. How is this going to change? And are there any details about what they're going to do? Because understand, Congress is basically, you know, not funded a lot of these agencies that would be out there. I mean, I look at what they're trying to do to OSHA, the NLRB. I'm looking at, you know, the cuts that Republicans want to do. How are they going to pull this off?
There are literally dozens of changes that they make. And so I don't know all the technical details, but one that jumped out to me that seems like a pretty major change is that Davis-Bacon will now be effective by operation of law, which is a legal term that means the DOL can demand back pay for workers, even if contractors say, wait, we didn't know we were subject to Davis-Bacon requirements, which seems like a no-brainer, right? I mean, if I go and shoplift a store and I say, hey, I didn't know shoplifting was illegal, that's still on me. They are, they're doing the same thing with contractors. It was the case for a long time that you had to spell out in bold type for contractors, by the way, you have to pay prevailing wage. Now that responsibility to know that they're getting federal money falls directly on contractors and subcontractors, which matters a lot because big brand name companies will try to evade some of these rules by outsourcing the work through shell companies and subcontractors. And so I think they're trying to put it back on the contractor to be aware of the legal requirements they're under.
So do we lock anybody up? Because I keep saying the only way this stuff changes is when the suits in the corner office are behind bars. Any chance we lock people up for this? Or is wage theft not really a crime in this country?
Unfortunately, I'm skeptical, but who knows?
It's not really a crime. I got you. Lee, I appreciate the time. Great stuff. Great report. I hope folks will take a look at it. We'll get links out so you can take a look at Lee Harris's report over at the American Prospect. Lee, thanks so much.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Good talking with you. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So Ruby Ridge was trending today, which told me a white guy must have got shot by the FBI. And lo and behold, that's what it was. I just saw Ruby Ridge was trending, and my mind went, man, the FBI must have shot a white guy who was pointing a gun at him. And evidently in Utah, that's what happened. Evidently, this guy in Provo had been making threats against the president, against New York prosecutor Alvin Bragg. I guess it even gotten into some, you know, going after Letitia James, the New York district attorney general, the U.S. attorney general, Merrick Garland, Gavin Newsom. You know, he was an equal opportunity, you know, threat maker. But evidently, he had the intent to kill, at a minimum, Bragg and Biden, according to court documents. So they went, because Biden's supposed to go to Utah, I guess, on Thursday. So they went to pick this guy up on a warrant. And, well, he did what they do. He put up a fight. And, well, he's dead. And it's one of those things where you just go, I've said this for years. And I tell my kids this. And it's, you know, when I grew up, the place to argue with the police is not on the side of the road. The argument never goes your way in public. It never goes your way on the side of the road or at your door. When the police come knocking, you got two choices. Open it and deal with the situation, or they're going to kick it in and probably shoot you. And this is what happened to Winston Four Eagles. That was his social media name, and that's how he decided to post his threats. Now, evidently, he owns a sniper rifle and, you know, the kind of things that you would use to take somebody out. And as I was reading through the reporting on this, and I believe it was CBS News who gave me this wonderful report, talking about the fact the guy had multiple guns and all this stuff. And that, you know taking out these, it was just a dream. What caught my attention more than anything, and, you know, some wacko with a gun, you know, getting into a shootout with the FBI, I generally don't spend a lot of time on. And that may sound cruel of me, but what caught my attention is at the end of the article, she said, you know, this is what they wrote. They're talking to the daughter-in-law of the guy who was killed. She said authorities have spoken to her husband, the guy's son, and he's trying to gather more information about what occurred. She said of how her husband was handling her father's death. He's just trying to process right now. I think that's all we're willing to talk about. This person said, added her father-in-law loved dogs and was a woodworker. He loved making sleighs and reindeer for Christmas. And my mind went to this place of going, wait a second. This is a guy who wanted to kill the president. This is a guy who put up a fight at the door with the FBI. Oh, he loved dogs and puppies, though. I mean, I saw this. I'm going, is this an attempt to gain sympathy? to gain some type of humanizing this person, CBS, do better. Simple, do better. And I know I'm going to get some hate mail. You shouldn't want to see it bad to happen to people, and I don't. But here's a thought. Here's a thought. Don't do what got him into trouble. Don't do this. Don't crime. I have never said that I was going to, on social media or anywhere else, do the kind of things that he talked about. And you probably haven't either. There's something, do we need mental health treatment for people? Probably. But the fact that the family didn't know and the son didn't know he had guns, give me a break. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1979. That was the day that young women workers at the YH Trading Company in Seoul, South Korea, staged a sit-in strike. The women made wigs for export. The company had been one of the leading exporters in the nation. But then the managers began to move the profits from the wig company to a shipping company under the same ownership, as well as to a film production company. This drained the profits from the wig factory and left it in massive debt. The owners shut down the company without warning, firing all of the employees. These women did not only lose their jobs. Water and electricity were turned off at the factory dormitories where the workers lived. A union represented the young women. The union planned a strike at the building, but the police were called in to break it up. The workers decided to move their protest to the local headquarters of the New Democratic Party. The party was in opposition to the leader of Seoul, President Park Chung-hee. The fired women were welcomed at the New Democratic Party headquarters. There, they decided to stage a sit-in to bring attention to their situation. The workers' sit-in only lasted 3 days. Then 1,000 police stormed the building. They overturned furniture and broke windows. They dragged the women out of the building violently. One woman, 21-year-old Kim Young-suk, died in the raid. She fell from the roof of the building in a clash with the police. 4 of the union leaders were sent to prison. More than 200 of the workers were expelled out of the city of Seoul and sent back home to rural areas. Today's Labor History in 2 brought to you in memory of Carol Hillman, a passionate friend of workers and volunteer of the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
How about a little bit of good news for a change? Specifically, good news about news. The demise of local newspapers has been a very depressing story in the last few years, with several thousand of them gobbled up by Wall Street profiteers. Those money powers loot the publication's assets, then callously shut down each community's paper or reduces them to empty news shelves. So, that's that. Local print journalism is passé, right? Wrong! High-spirited, community-minded subscribers in places like Glen Rose, Texas, Hamburg, Iowa, Portland, Maine, and International Falls, Minnesota, are humming an upbeat tune of regeneration that could be titled, Not Dead Yet. In Maine, for example, 5 of the state's 6 daily papers and 17 weeklies were sinking under the ownership of an investment group. But all were recently bought by the National Trust for Local News, a nonprofit started 2 years ago. The trust is turning each publication over to local nonprofit owners and helping them find ways to become sustainable. Another new effort called Cherry Road Media has bought 77 rural papers in 17 states, most from the predatory Gannett conglomerate that wanted to dump them. Cherry Road's business plan is simple, old-time genius. Return editorial decision-making to local people and journalists who know the town. Be an active presence and participant in community affairs. Make the locals responsible for sustaining their town's paper and, most important, reinvest profits in real local journalism that advances democracy. This is Jim Hightower saying, in both of these new initiatives, the foremost mission is to serve the common good of the communities, not to pad the wealth of a few distant financiers. To learn more about these models and how you might implement something similar in your town, contact Institute for Rural Journalism, ruraljournalism.org. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is made possible by you subscribers to Jim Hightower's Lowdown on Sunday.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, huge victory yesterday in Ohio. And in fact, you know, heard a lot about what's going on. One county. This is remarkable. When someone tells you, hey, your vote doesn't matter, one county in Ohio, Clark County, Ohio, one vote. 16,015 people voted no, and one vote separated the no's and the yes's. That's quite remarkable. And this, again, why people should be voting. And here to share some thoughts on the big win in Ohio and maybe give us some insight on the, you know, how they got the turnout, how they got people to vote, and what this is going to mean going forward. I've asked Liz Walters to come talk with us. Liz is the chair of the Ohio Democratic Party. You want to check out their website, ohiodems.org. Liz, thanks for taking some time for us.
Hey, Rick, thanks so much for having me. It's exciting to be here with you.
So this is a pretty big deal, but this one little nugget, I've been fixated on this one little nugget,
yeah.
One vote for the no side, 16,015 no, 16,014 yes. That just shows me every vote matters.
100%. I think that this whole victory you saw in Ohio showed us how much our democracy matters. And I'm really proud that Ohio voters showed up to overwhelmingly reject this anti-democratic move from the out-of-touch GOP leaders in Ohio State House and Secretary of State Frank LaRose. And what you saw across Ohio was volunteers, activists, from a bipartisan, broad coalition of folks, stand up, talk to their fellow voters, their fellow citizens about what was at stake in this election, and really make their voice heard. And those margins in our big counties where we saw, you know, a much wider spread than one vote, but also in those counties where those races were close, what that comes down to is, you know, just good old fashioned elbow grease and door knocking, right? So folks were out all summer talking to voters and it paid off. And it, I think, is a renewed kind of hope, a renewed belief in the democratic process here in Ohio. And we're excited to take a small minute to celebrate, but we'll be right back at it for the fall election here before too long.
Yeah, no, look, you know, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, you know, still in my heart. To see it be as radical and as crazy as it's been, to see this turnout, to see this vote, almost a 60-40, I guess, is probably going to be close to the numbers, to see it that decisive of a response to what was really an overreach and, and you know, honestly, I don't know how with a straight face a Republican go, no, we banned special elections, but for this, well, we're going to break our ban.
Agreed. And I think my favorite post-election analysis from Senator Matt Huffman was the, well, we didn't win because we didn't have enough time to campaign after you set the election date, dude. Come on, give me a break. You got beat fair and square. The Ohio people stood up and told you to take a hike and shove these anti-democratic ideas back in the box they came from. So I think across Ohio, voters were focused. And, you know, more importantly, I think they sent a strong message to those out-of-touch corrupt politicians in the state house that we won't go back. And two, no matter how you might try to rig the game or manipulate us by, you know, putting something on the August ballot, hoping we won't notice and it would just slip through. When you mess with our democracy, that's a bad bet every time. We're gonna stand up for democracy every time.
Now, you know, look, you look at these special elections, especially off-year special elections, generally much lower turnout, and generally Republicans and conservatives are get out in much higher numbers. And in looking at that, and I don't know how much more of a Democratic turnout was there yet. I haven't really, you know, digested all those numbers. But in looking at this and seeing that, you know, even in places that you would have thought would have been overwhelmingly, you know, Republican leaning, like Clark County that went for Trump by 23 points, that this issue Because this really wasn't just about the Constitution and that stuff. This was about the abortion issue that's coming up in November, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. So, you know, Secretary of State Frank LaRose said the quiet part out loud that this fight was 100% about abortion. So we knew that in order for us to ensure abortion rights in Ohio got a free, fair election in November, we had to defeat state issue one. And we showed up and showed out, right? But I think we also knew that while yesterday's election was about abortion, it was also about union rights. It was about voting rights. It was about fair maps. It was about civil rights and a whole host of important issues that Ohio care about. Those not having access to a citizen-led ballot initiative over the decades to come puts all of those things at risk. Ultimately, the ballot initiative process is the tool by which Ohio voters hold our elected officials accountable with when they are out of touch with the majority's will. Right. We have been judicious stewards of that. We haven't abused it or overused it. But given the state of our state house currently, we know it's a tool we need to hang on to.
Yeah, but the reason I bring this up is because, you know, if it was that issue, if really the abortion issue was front and center that issue, Republicans have a problem in November. Because, you know, I look at the same polling I'm sure that you look at. Even Republicans don't want Roe to have been overturned. They want abortion to be safe and legal, and probably more rare than most people. But they still don't want people dying in back alleys. And I think this issue is a real problem for the GOP.
I agree. And I think it also is a real clarifying moment about choices that Ohio voters have. Right? One group wants to protect our freedoms, including women's freedom to make healthcare choices with the privacy of their family and their doctors without the interference of politicians. And the other side thinks that state legislators belong in the doctor's office with you. It's that simple. And so as we go into the fall, those choices are going to be made very clear for Ohio voters, but it's also something that we'll continue to carry into 2024 as we talk about the elections coming up next year too, because I think the stakes have never been higher.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Liz Walter. She's the chair of the Ohio Democratic Party. You can check out their website, ohiodems.org. We'll get links out on social media, how you can take a look at this. Now, you know, again, huge victory. The messaging coming out of this, I think, is fabulous. You're taking on, you know, an overreaching Republican majority in your House and Senate. And good. I mean, this is something we have to have. But, you know, then the pivot is, you know, asking the simple question, how is any of this making working people's lives better? How is any of this going to help families put food on the table and parents help their kids, you know, transition into adulthood? How is this going to make lives better? I don't see how any of this, any of the chaos we see by Republicans in Washington or in Columbus, I don't see how any of this makes workers' lives better.
I couldn't agree more. And I think Ohio voters deserve an answer about why the GOP leadership in this state spent $20 million of their hard-earned tax money on an illegal August special election on an issue that none of us wanted. Frankly, they should all ask for a refund. But more importantly, it speaks to their priorities. And as the legislative session came to an end earlier this spring, you know what we weren't talking about? We weren't talking about wages. We weren't talking about jobs. We weren't talking about prescription drug costs. They were talking about extreme stances on issues out of alignment with most of Ohio voters. And hopefully this is something we can keep reminding folks of going forward as we come into the fall this year.
No, I mean, this is the central issue. The central issue is always, how are you going to make the kitchen table a happier place? How are you going to be able to help working people put a roof over their head, food on that table, and make lives better? All of the divisive stuff, all of this stuff that Republicans keep throwing at us, you know, from abortion to same-sex marriage to whatever, is all meant to keep us in the red hat, blue hat category, keep us divided and eating each other while they rob us blind. And I want the Democrats to be the party of Roosevelt. I want them to be the party of Sherrod Brown and Joe Biden and really hammer on, hey, you know, we are making lives better. We're doing the hard work of making prevailing wage stronger so workers who are building this country back up again are going to make a good wage and it's going to help communities. That, to me, that just seems like the issue.
I couldn't agree more. And I think that as we have these hard conversations, one of the other important things that issue one did was gave Ohioans an opportunity to find common ground. As you've noted, the extremism we're seeing out of the GOP these days has been polarizing and pushes us into camps. And our defeat of State Issue 1 was a bipartisan coalition of folks from around the state who believe in democracy, who were able to point to the values we share. And I was telling folks going into this, you know, I'm from a big Irish cat, working class Irish Catholic family. We don't all agree on politics, and had a family gathering a couple weeks out, and my devout Trump supporter cousin walked in my house and goes, "Hey, I really like your yard sign, that no on issue one yard sign." I said, "Okay, that's a funny joke." And he goes, no, I'm serious. This thing is bullshit. Power should belong to the people. Like, freedom matters, and who stands for freedom is important to me. So I'm voting no on issue one. First time in a minute we voted the same way in an election, but also an important moment for us to kind of clarify the conversation with voters across the state about who stands for what.
Yeah, no, look, and this is, I talk about this all the time, so I'm glad you brought this up, because people, when I say, you know, Joe Walsh, the former congressman from Illinois, is someone who I call a friend, people are like, "Oh my God, I can't believe it. You're a conservative." No, we both believe in democracy. We don't agree on anything else. We both want to make sure that that ballot box is shows the will of the people, and that we follow the Constitution and we believe in democracy. Again, nothing else. But on this, this is where we can pull people back together. So I'm so spot on with what you said there.
Yes, it is an incredible opportunity for us to have those conversations as we move, again, through this year, but also into 24. We know that, you know, the work is not done. The work continues in Ohio. We have a long ways to go still, but this is an important victory in a long war for kind of the soul of our state and for the lives of working people across Ohio.
Yeah. Now, last line of questioning I've got for you, because this obviously is going to be a launching pad for 2024. You know, obviously this November and next year as well. And out of this, I think having a real conversation about the abortion issue, I think, is something that has to be had, because what we've learned from our Republican friends, and maybe you'll come with me on this, maybe you won't, but what I've learned is when they talk about, you know, the abortion issue, they're just anti-abortion. They're certainly not pro-life, because I've seen no one come forth with healthcare, with education, with food programs, with anything that's going to help these mothers that you're forcing to bring children into this world. I've seen none of them bring policies that are going to help in that way. And look, I'm a kid who grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland with a single mother. So I know what empty cupboards look like, and I know what it means to have government be helpful. We're not seeing this from the Republicans, and I wish someone would hammer on this. It's great to say that you're anti-abortion, but don't try and fool me with pro-life, because you don't give a rat's behind about kids once they're born, only when they're in the fetus.
Listen, and there is data point after data point in Ohio that backs up exactly what you just said. I think the most important, one of the most important points we often miss here too is maternal health in Ohio. Ohio still has an outsized amount of maternal death in this state, and it is particularly profound for Black mothers and African-American women in our state. And so at a time when we should be doing more to ensure that families are healthy, to ensure that women are healthy and have the ability to make choices about their healthcare, we are taking important medical decisions off the table and giving them over to politicians in the state house who want to ban free school lunches, who want to ban teaching of science, who want to ban birth control. And so I don't know where these folks kind of come up, cook up some of these ideas, but I think overwhelmingly we will see Ohioans unite behind promoting reproductive freedom, promoting freedom for women and families to have a safer, healthier life.
I got to tell you, let's hope this election is a launching pad to do some great things here in November, and then carry that on into 2024. And maybe my state, my former state of Ohio, will find its way back to a bit of sanity. I'm hoping. I'm always hopeful. But Liz, I appreciate
one election at a time. We'll get there.
There you go. Always appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Rick. Great to see you. Have a great rest of the day.
You as well. Liz Walters, chair of the Ohio Democratic Party. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1927. That was the day the California School Employees Association was founded. Today, the union includes more than 215,000 members. But it all started with just 9 men and 1 woman. This group of determined Oakland custodians wanted to improve their voice on the job. They had come together to support an elderly custodian who could not afford to retire because public school employees did not have a pension plan. They met for 3 days to develop the framework of their union. Their first priority was to establish retirement benefits for custodians. Just 1 year after the union was founded, they met their first goal. They helped to push a bill through the California legislature that provided retirement for all school employees, not just teachers. Within 10 years, the union had grown to 10,000 members. They continued to work through the legislative process to win a 40-hour work week, sick leave, and protections against age discrimination. For decades, the union has stood on the front lines against the drastic public education budget cuts. During the 1980s, the union pushed for the cleanup of asbestos in California schools. They knew this was important for the health and safety of both the union members and the students they served. Since then, the California School Employees Association has continued to fight for safe schools and fair working conditions. In 2001, they affiliated with the AFL-CIO. Today, the union represents members who perform security work, food service, office and clerical work, maintenance, transportation, and library services. In short, without these essential workers, there would be no public education. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, ricksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Want to get to a couple of emails as we wrap up today. Sandra sent me, I get this one occasionally, and I'm glad Sandra sent it. She said, Mr. Smith, I have listened to your show for the past year, and generally I agree with you, but your repeated attacks on Christians is hurting your message. As a churchgoer and believer in Jesus, I am tired of liberals attacking our beliefs. Does it mean that much to you to tear us down? Is it such an infringement on your life that you mock and ridicule us? I think you would get more people on your side if you stopped attacking good people of faith. Have a blessed day, Sandra. I don't think I've ever attacked a good person of faith. I actually know a lot of good people of faith. And they are the types who don't do the judgment, don't pass the judgment. They're the ones who will help feed the hungry and clothe the naked and heal the sick. And they are the people who are community-minded, and they live by examples. And when I read your email, Sandra, it's one of these things, I don't think I've ever attacked Christianity or Christians. I've attacked hypocrites. I've gone after people who, I don't know, tell me that Jesus talks to them and that they've told them to do things like, you know, end abortion, but not do anything else. Like, that's it. You know, the day over, you know, but check. Now, as to meaning that much, I always use the Neil Young phrase. It doesn't mean that much to mean that much to you. I, in this country, believe everybody has the right to pursue their happiness, but whether it be religion or not. I don't talk about my faith. I don't talk about what we do because I don't think it's germane to what we do. I want to live my life the best way possible. The golden rule, at least the silver. My problem is people who hide behind religion and beliefs so that you can't question their motives or what they do. This is my problem in today's world. Most of the people who proclaim to be religious, who wear their religiosity on their sleeves, in my view, are not good people. They do some of the worst, most heinous things. They pursue policies that are destructive for humanity. Just my view. Now, I have, as I said, I have known really good, decent, honest, hardworking people of faith. And I was thinking about, as I was reading your email, I was thinking about my wife's stepfather, who you wouldn't have never known what his faith was. You would have never known that he went to church. You would have never known anything other than by watching the man. He was a good, decent man who would help anyone. Never preached, never asked for anything in return. Led a good life, was a good person. Can we get more Christians like him? Not the person who in the middle of a crowded restaurant feels the need to stand up and you know, shout their pre-meal prayer, showing us all how wonderful they are. How about just leading a life by example instead of preaching? That's what I would like. But I appreciate you tuning in, Sandra. Thank you. Lewis sent me an email, said, I just want to point out that why the Democratic Party lost the white working class is not just due to social liberalism Democrats embraced. It was also the elevation of the neoliberalist corporatist wing of the party and their advocacy of policies that was anti-worker. Lewis, spot on. 100% agree. Without question. He goes on to say, which made the Democratic Party indistinguishable from the Republican Party. Hence, allowing the GOP just saying it was mainly identity politics that drove away the white working class is too simplistic and incomplete as an explanation. No, you're spot on and you're not wrong. But, you know, here's the thing. I think the point that was made earlier is a lot of Democrats at the, you know, working class Democrats, especially when we went through Iowa. When we went through Iowa, a lot of those folks were socially conservative, but voted for Democrats for economic reasons, because they were New Deal type Democrats, where it's about putting food on the table. It's about wages, hours, conditions. It's about holding corporate power in check. So when Democrats, DLC Clinton type Democrats came along and were, as you've said, indistinguishable from Republicans, they then went to, now it's the social stuff. Now it's the, you know, the gay marriage and all of the other things. And the right played on it masterfully. You're right. So telling the complete story is when Democrats turned their back on working people and policies that were put forth to allow a lot of this horrible stuff, all of the neoliberalism, you lost people. But we're in a moment now, and I think you'll agree, Lewis, that we're in a moment right now that we've got a guy in the White House who's trying to undo some of that. Now you go, but Rick, he was part of that. Yeah, he was. And I completely... You know, when he was in the Senate, there were votes I did not like. But the reality is, right now, the policies that he's moving, we should be celebrating in the streets. Now, is it making everyone's life better? No, but we're on a path to do that. We're on a path to make those working class jobs good jobs again. The kind that one income can support a family. You go back and you think about those New Deal era policies that said, you know what, we're going to pay a factory worker $100,000 a year so that they can survive, they can make a living, they can support a family, they can thrive. You know, right now you got this race to the bottom. And look, that didn't happen out of benevolence. Those wages weren't because corporations thought you were worth it. They didn't. They hated it. They did it because workers had power. Unions had strength. Policy was in place to ensure that there was a floor. It's all politics. So when my kids go to me, Dad, you know, why are you so hung up on politics? Because that's how stuff gets done. There's no invisible hand. There's no invisible man going to make these decisions for us. We've got to do it ourselves. And we've got to demand better. As I've said 1,000 times, all of that socially liberal stuff, you know, I think I'm on the right side of history with, but it's not central to what I think we should be focused on. You know, the transgender issue, I've said this 1,000 times. We dealt with in my workplace 30 years ago. When Ross went away and came back as Rosie, nobody cared. Rosie got the same wages that Ross got. Same working conditions, same days off, same seniority. We've got to get back to that. And I think Biden is moving us in that direction. We have to be the ones to come along, though. He's pointing the direction.